Well, please do turn to the passage that John read to us earlier on from Matthew chapter 7 as we progress through the Sermon on the Mount. But of course, bearing in mind that the Sermon on the Mount is set in the whole of Matthew's Gospel. It's not just sort of a separate bit that happens to have been inserted at this point. It's part and parcel of the same message which Matthew is teaching to those who are like him, Jews, to persuade them that the Jesus whom they have rejected is in actual fact the Messiah that they were looking for. That what they've done is in effect sort of pull the rug from under their own feet. But it's not too late because they can turn to the Messiah. So this terrific evangelistic tract, longer than any evangelistic tract you've ever read, is sent by Matthew to people who can see afresh that Jesus is the Messiah, that he is the Christ, that he is God's anointed, that he is the one that they know they need. And as Jesus teaches, then he teaches here in the Sermon on the Mount, as he does throughout Matthew's Gospel, on the kingdom. And at this point in Matthew's Gospel, 7:13 following, we come across something which is part and parcel of Jesus' teaching, but we come across it here so clearly, something which is so totally countercultural for us, something which offends deeply most of what goes on out with the church, and sadly goes on also within the visible church of the Lord Jesus Christ. What Jesus does here is, in the language of Don Carson, in one of the chapter headings in his book, The Gagging of God, what Jesus does here is to draw lines when drawing lines is rude. What he does is to create a dividing line. And everybody is on one side of the line or the other. The line is not wide enough to stand on. And Jesus makes it clear that you can't have a foot on either side and swither and weigh it all up or be sophisticated and have your cake and eat it. You're either on one path or another path. You're either in or you're out of the kingdom. But of course, Jesus here in the Sermon on the Mount is teaching so that people might decide. Not simply so that they might have information, but so that they might reach a decision. And therefore decide, in tonight's context, which path they're going to walk through this life. So, the section begins in verse 13 with Jesus in two relatively short verses, laying everything before the people. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So, there are two gates, two entrances to the future from this point on. There are two roads, and the road is the conduct, the way you choose to live, your walk in this life, which scripturally is not so much the route you're taking, although there is a destination that will come into a moment. It's the way you walk. It's the path you choose describes your conduct, describes the way you live in this life, the way you relate to other people, the decisions and choices you make in this life. It's a conduct thing rather than a planning thing, if you like. Well, two gates, two roads, that is two ways to live, two kinds of conduct. And there are two destinations, two outcomes of the choice that was made way back at the gate. Two outcomes of those two ways to live. Two gates, two roads, two destinations. Now, at this point, we have to just do a little bit of a step back and ask a question or two of the text. So look at it with me. When Jesus says, enter through the narrow gate, For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Is he talking about two ways to live, one of which leads you to hell and the other leads you to heaven? Or is he talking about two ways to live the Christian life? That is, everybody that he's talking about has entered, but, you know, there are two ways to live the Christian life. There's a broad way to live the Christian life, and there's a narrow way to live the Christian life. Now, there are commentators who will come down on either side of that question. And usually the ones who come down on the second choice there, that he's describing two ways to live the Christian life, if we can put it in those terms, say that the destruction that Jesus is talking about here is not the ultimate destruction of going to hell, but it is the destruction of our works. And the reference is made to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul talks about the judgment not of ourselves, but of what we've done, of our works. Just flick forward, if you will, with me, and you'll see what I'm talking about there. And then, once you've seen what I'm talking about, you'll be able to promptly forget it. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10. If you've got one of our church Bibles, page 1146. And it's worth just taking a moment or two just to sort this out for ourselves, so that we're clear in our own minds what Jesus is and is not talking about. And that way, we grasp something of the importance and the force of what Jesus is saying. So 1 Corinthians 3:10. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day, and of course, Jesus talks about that day in our passage this evening in Matthew's Gospel. The day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If what he has built is burnt up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, so you're not losing your salvation, but only as one escaping through the flames. So here's the picture that Paul paints of us approaching the sort of the assessment of what we've done as Christians. Not the judgment between those who are going to be in heaven and those who are going to be in hell, but the assessment of what we've done as Christians. The assessment of our deeds. And it's like a testing with fire. So we're all going to approach this. And it's as if what we've done in this life, what we've done with the gifts that God has given us, is like stuff that we're carrying on our backs. And what we're carrying on our backs is either gold and silver and costly precious metals and costly stones and jewels and stuff. In which case, the fire won't make a scrap of difference to it. It will endure, and we and our works will go in there. The good things that we've done, that God has prepared for us and saved us for. For doing. Alternatively, if what we have been doing through this life has been not building with these enduring substances, if what we've been doing with this life is just basically we've become a Christian, but then we just live for ourselves. We've become a Christian, but we haven't used the things that the gifts that God has given us for His kingdom and for His glory and for the good of His people, for the spreading of the gospel. We've just used it to you know, line our own nests and all the rest of it, then that's like carrying wood, hay, and straw on our backs. And of course, if you're going to go through a fire with wood, hay, and straw on your back, it's going to burn up, it's going to be tested, and it's going to go. So you'll get through, because the flames won't touch you, but the flames will touch what you've done, and it'll either endure, or it won't. So you'll get through the other side, and there'll be this strange smell of burning. And you know it's not your hair, and you know it's not the person next to you, and they're a curious aftershave, it must have been what's on your back, which ain't there anymore. Now, that's what some commentators make of what Jesus is saying here, that everybody enters, so it must be taught, both are entering the kingdom. What else would you enter? But for some, what they've done is destroyed. For others, what they've done endures. Now, I'm telling you all that in case you come across it anywhere else. And so that you know that I've done my homework. Well, not really. I don't think it's right. And I don't think it's right for two reasons. First, destruction is always on Jesus' lips. A final separating judgment from God. It is never just the testing of the things you've done. It is a final separating judgment from God that separates people from Him. Destruction is what will, that sort of separating judgment is what befalls the fate of, in verse 23, those who He never knew. Those who are false. Those who are bad trees. Who have borne bad fruit. That's the first thing. That the word destruction is far, far more naturally on Jesus' lips. Far, far more commonly on Jesus' lips. Almost exclusively. Destruction and its associated words, to do with that final judgment by which God separates people away from Himself for eternity. Second reason is that the destinations are either destruction or life. If you interpret it as being just the destruction of your works, but you get through, a la 1 Corinthians chapter 3, then the destinations would in fact be life and life. Wouldn't they? But they are destruction and life. Not destruction and endurance of your works, but destruction or life. And that puts the whole thing about the two gates, the two entrances, the two roads and the two destinations on a far, far more serious footing for us. You see, Jesus is speaking to a mixed multitude. He went and sat down to teach His disciples, and there are loads of other people listening. He's speaking to the crowd, which will follow Him for a while, but then will turn away from Him. He's speaking to the crowd, some of whom love the broad way with many on it, and do not want a narrow way with only a few on it. And so as Jesus speaks, and speaks here, He is already sifting those who are listening. He's already confronting them with a choice. From now on, as you enter the future, as you enter the rest of your days, from now on, as you progress through the days, conducting yourself in one of two ways, from now on, as you head towards one of only two inevitable destinations, which will it be? And of course, that is so incredibly rude. It is just mind-bogglingly unsophisticated, isn't it? It is just awfully, awfully immature. There is really nothing nuanced about this at all. There is nothing about it that speaks of that open kind of toleration which acknowledges that everybody's views are valid and that really, you know, there are many, many ways to God. And really, when we stop and think about it, who are we to say that anybody's road is not going to lead to God? Which is what is thought out there, and which is what is thought increasingly by the people who gather in buildings like this, and by the people who stand in buildings like this, in this kind of place. And it's what is being taught with increasing boldness and with increasing candor and self-confidence by people who stand in places like this. that to make such a distinction, to say that there are only two departure points for the future of your life, to say that there are only two ways to live, to say that there are only two ways to die. Well, actually, the offensive thing is that there are two and not just one, where everybody gets in. To say that is just so crass, so old-fashioned, so uninformed. And to do the thing that Jesus says here, that to say that the narrow road is the one, when narrowness of mind is one of the worst things you can say about somebody. Oh, they're just so narrow-minded. So Jesus here becomes again the offensive Jesus. And if we're going to go out with the gospel, then we have to go out knowing that what we've got from Jesus is going to offend. And we've got to bear in mind that what we've got from Jesus will offend people in churches as well as people who would never darken the door of one. But you see, as far as Jesus is concerned, if we don't speak the truth, then we are not being compassionate. We are not being like him. If we don't say to people that the way we live our lives, the path that we choose, has final, eternal consequences, then what we're speaking is not a gospel. It's not the gospel of God. If we're not prepared to say that you can be out as well as in the kingdom of God, then we're not being true to Jesus. If we're not prepared to say that narrowness is freedom, then we're not being true to Jesus. Charles Price, in his commentary on Matthew, even though Charles does go the 1 Corinthians 3 route, but he's a great guy, very helpfully talks about this narrowness, which, you know, today is an insult. If someone said that you're narrow-minded, then they're, you know, they're calling you thick and bigoted and all the rest of it and ignorant. He talks about a time when he was flying from Canada to London, I think it is. And he went up, the jumbo jet, he went up to the flight deck, as one does, and said, "Hello, I'm not a terrorist, it's just me. I'm an evangelist," which would really get you thrown off right there in midair. And he got talking to the pilot, and they weren't that long into the flight, and he just said something which revealed the fact that Charles was assuming that now they were up and on their way, the pilot would have a fairly easy time of it, didn't need to be thinking about things that much, that all the activity had to do with taking off and landing. And the pilot said to him, "No, that's not the case. Actually, we've got to keep on the ball all the time, because on this flight, since it's quite a long way from where I was in Canada to Charles, the minister in Toronto, to London, if you're 1 degree out, you're going to end up hundreds of miles out at the end of the day. You'll be nowhere near London. So you have to actually keep a very narrow line on this flight, and you have to keep to it all the way along. And it's no use just sort of switching off for a while, or you'll find yourself landing, well, I don't know, where could you land a few hundred miles? Well, you could land in Aberdeen accidentally. Can you imagine a jumbo jet coming in just over the flats there, this huge thing, bigger than the runway? All these people getting off, all these Canadians like Bill and Anne getting off thinking, is this London? And all these people rushing out and saying, buy our goods, they're much better than the ones you'll find in London. So, you see, the narrowness is the good thing. It is not a narrowness that has to do with ignorance and bigotry. It is the narrowness that has to do with saying no to the kind of life that God's people have got themselves into at the end of Judges in the Old Testament, where, quotes, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. You see, it is life-saving that it is narrow. It is life-savingly gracious and merciful to God that he says to us when we are following him, when we are walking in his path, when he says to us, don't do that. Don't go there. Don't go down that alley. Don't veer off down that road there. Don't go into that. It is gracious and merciful of God to keep saying to us, go there, go there, follow my son, follow my do my will. Because we know that everything other than the will of God for us is worse for us than the will of God. Everything that is not the will of God is worse for us. And then Jesus takes these things and expands on them. Because when we're making these choices about the way we live, there are voices, there are persuasive voices, there are people giving us their advice, people giving us the benefit of their wisdom, there are people telling us that what they're saying to us is authoritative and it's the real Christian voice, it's the real voice of Jesus and all that kind of thing. And Jesus therefore warns people for false prophets, against false prophets. Verses 15 through 23. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. And then he switches the imagery from wolves and sheep to trees and fruit. By their fruit you will recognize them. Now, fruit here has the same sort of connotation as fruit in Galatians 5, 22 and 23 that we're looking at on Tuesdays at the lunchtime service when we're talking about the fruit of the Spirit. Fruit is another word, if you like, for what comes out because of what's inside. It is the outward evidence of what a person is on the inside. Now, in Galatians 5, 22 and 23, Paul describes outward evidence of the Spirit's presence, of the Spirit's controlling presence on the inside. For the fruit of the Spirit, he says. One fruit, many segments. This is just the evidence that's going to show in all sorts of ways, in different situations that you're in. Evidence of the Spirit will come out. In different situations, different evidence will come out. But if the Spirit's within you, it's going to show on the outside, like the kind of tree that a particular tree is, will show in the fruit that you can see upon it. So the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, temperance, goodness, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, meekness, temperance, faith in the Authorized Version. And we're coming to faithfulness on Tuesday here. Now, that's the kind of thing that fruit means here. You will recognize a person's true character. You will know what kind of a person they are by the evidence of their lives. By the things they do, the things they say. By their fruit, you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes? Answer? No. See? Profound exegesis. Well done. Here's another one. Do people pick figs from thistles? You've got it. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit. And a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. See what Jesus says there? See how rude it is? See how discriminatory he is? By our standards. By our Western postmodern standards. By the standards of our nuanced liberalized theology. That are so prevalent within the church. A good tree, well, it might bear some fruit, which of course is questionable and might not be what you would want. But of course, there's some good in all of us, isn't there? And you know, We mustn't judge people. We mustn't come to these rash decisions and use this categorical rash language about people, which can be so offensive and frankly so divisive. Codswallop. Jesus says, a good tree cannot bear bad fruit. Simple as that. And a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Why can't a bad tree bear good fruit? Because it's not just the deed, it's how the deed is done. It's the motive for the deed. Two people can do exactly the same thing. Two people can go and help a beggar in the street. And one person will be doing it to satisfy themselves and to look good because they know that somebody that they value is watching them and it will be the kind of thing that would impress them. And they know they can afford to go and help the beggar. So they're doing it for themselves. Another person can't really afford to, but he's going to. Doesn't care who's watching, knows that it might be a mug's game, but is going to help anyway because it's the virtuous thing to do. Might not be helping with money, by the way. Same deed. One of them bad. The other good. And what makes the difference? Not just the action. But what's gone on in the heart? The bad heart has done the thoroughly self-interested thing. The good heart has done the good thing. Two politicians might speak out against an injustice. One, because they know that their constituency is listening, they want to sound good, and they dare not speak out because it would look bad if they didn't. The other, just because they ought to. You see, Jesus is absolutely right, isn't he? Absolutely right. We, because we don't like the thought of being bad in this way, put so much spin on our humanity. Go through so many convoluted denials of the possibility that we might be heading for hell. Do anything we can to avoid that. Do anything we can to squirm out from under a God who sees and knows and judges. That we will even dismiss what Jesus says by marginalizing it, neutralizing it, qualifying it to death, or just plain ignoring it. So Jesus, as he describes these two ways to live, these two paths, these two ways to walk, as he urges the people to walk the right path, the path that is narrow, but the path that leads to life, the path that doesn't have many people on it, because it's not popular. And it doesn't make you popular to walk this path. As he describes this, he's saying, look, there are voices who will tell you to walk the other way. Don't listen to them. Look at the way they live. And see in their conduct, in the fruit of their lives, that which gives the lie to their words. What will happen to them? Well, they will be cut down and thrown into the fire. Verse 19. Verse 23. Jesus will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. They look good. They can use the right words, but the life of God is not in them. Jesus says that it's those who do his will. Look at verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. The fruit reveals the state of the tree. So where are we? Well, my guess is that nearly all of us here, if not all of us here, are walking, having entered through a narrow gate that isn't all that obvious, only a few find it. Not that we found it ourselves, we found it because God opened our eyes to it. And we're walking that narrow road, which is not particularly popular and which seems very limiting to most people, seems very sort of prescribed and very restrictive to most people. Seems like your style's being cramped in a fairly major way to most people, but we're walking that narrow way, and we actually know that that's the way of freedom. And we know where we're going, not because we're particularly good and better than other people or anything like that, but because we know that God has opened his kingdom for us, which is an eternal kingdom. I guess most of us are there. But you know, there isn't a day passes when any one of us could not find ourselves listening to the false prophets. There isn't a day when every one of us doesn't hear the persuasive pull of those who look good and sound good, but will pull us away to do our will or their will, and not the will of the Father of Jesus who is in heaven. Tomorrow, you and I will feel the pull of the broad way. Will we listen? Will we progress along this narrow way, always going as close to the edge of it as possible? Always going as close to the brink as we can. Always seeing if I can get a little bit further away from the will of our Father in heaven, a little bit further nearer the will of the world. Is that how we'll live? Is that what we'll do tomorrow? To see how far we can go? Or will we thank God for the narrowness of the way? And will we do what some people are absolutely gifted to do in their motor cars, and that is drive down the white line in the middle? Because we know that our Heavenly Father defines a way for us which leads to life. I guess that's where most of us are, but if you're here this evening and you're listening to the Bible, maybe for the first time, or you've heard it all before, then Jesus' question to you is really, really simple, isn't it? It's which way are you going to be on? Now, tonight, you're standing before two gates, two entrances to your future. Your future. Now you've got your choice about your future. You've got your choice about the way you will live. And nobody else can choose for you. You can't choose for anybody else. We're not talking here about humanity in general. We're not having some great highfalutin conversation about the universe, life, meaning, and everything else. We're talking about your life, your future, how you're going to live it. Which one will it be? Jesus Christ, the most significant man in the history of the planet, the one who has changed more than anybody else has changed, the one whom most people would say he's a great teacher. Well, this is what he teaches. It's your life.
Which gate will you choose? No one can choose for you. Which gate will you choose? Which way will you walk? Which destination do you want? Let's pray.